Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books and Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Joel Cherney. My guest today is Bernard F. Dick, author of the book Engulfed, The Death of Paramount Pictures and the Birth of Corporate Hollywood, published in 2021 by University Press of Kentucky. In our talk, we discuss Paramount as an example of how a major studio from the early days of Hollywood was taken over by an outside company and became a part of the regular business economy. I hope you enjoy my interview with Bernard F. Dick. Hi, Bernard. How are you today?
I'm fine. And yourself?
I'm very good. Thank you. We're talking about your book, Engulfed, The Death of Paramount Pictures and the Birth of Corporate Hollywood, coming out in a new edition with updated introduction that updates the material from the original edition. But all the material in here is a discussion of what became the corporation Paramount, or became part of other corporations, but started as one of the first studios in Hollywood. So let's talk a little bit about your background. Obviously, this is not your first book or only book on the subject of movies. It is basically your background. Talk a little bit about how you got into film in the first place. I know you were a professor, and then you've written a number of books, including also another studio. So let's talk a little bit about where how you first started working with film study.
Well, actually, I don't have a degree in film studies. As a matter of fact, my doctorate is in Latin and Greek. Which does sound odd, but, you know, in the 70s, when people started taking film seriously, a lot of us who had degrees in other disciplines like English, like history, just developed this interest in film because we grew up with it and it had become an academic discipline and therefore, at least in many circles, respectable. So I gravitated to film. I had an opportunity to teach a course in the history of film, and that led to my doing a textbook called Anatomy of Film, and then from then on, it was just one thing after another. So I just stayed in film. I moved out of classical languages, I moved out of literary criticism, and into film criticism. So for me, it was a very natural journey. Although I know it sounds odd going from Latin and Greek to film.
Well, you were right about the time period. I can think of another profession where that kind of thing happened, and that's computers. Early on, when the schools weren't putting out people, there was a lot of quote-unquote on-the-job training back in the 70s and 80s, and people were just hired and worked through it and learned things as they go. And nowadays, as with film, it's become a more normal degree program, or at least study program. I know some of your other books, I mean, obviously, Hal Wallace is important to Paramount's story, and you wrote a book about him. You've written one on Audrey Hepburn, I think, and then didn't
Lillian Hellman And I never did anything on Audrey Hepburn. Billy Wilder and Harry Cohn of Columbia Pictures, yeah.
Right. So I hesitate to call it the golden age of Hollywood because that's a word that's used regularly, but...
Well, it was, though.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's still called that, and yet one of the things that I, with all the reading I do about older Hollywood producers, directors, actors, and studios is they were definitely, the studio system was producing a lot of stuff, and while we obviously have our well-known movies from that period of time, there was a lot of other things, the B-movies and even some of the so-called top bill movies are unfortunately forgotten as well, although we're starting to see more and more availability of them in so many different formats in the days of streaming and other online formats. So let's talk about Paramount Films, though, or Paramount Pictures, because that's the reason. What made you decide at the time that this was ripe for a book on the subject? I know you in the introduction you specifically state that it's not meant to be an overall history of the studio, but obviously it turns into one because of the way you had to cover it from the beginning. What led you to work on Paramount?
Well, I always look for archives. And it's just so happened that George Welsner, who was the last president of Paramount Pictures before it was absorbed by Gulf and Western, left his papers at the American Heritage Institute at the University of Wyoming in Laramie. And I think once I discovered that there was a real treasure trove there, I realized that a book would naturally come out of all of this because nobody else had previously used the Welsner papers. So that was part of it. Also, I was very interested in what happened in the silent, it is called Silent Movie, the Mel Brooks film, in which Sid Caesar plays a studio head who discovers that his little studio has been taken over by what was called in the movie Engulf and Devour, which is obviously Gulf and Western. And that, coupled with the fact that growing up as I did in the 1940s, Paramount Pictures was really probably at the time my favorite studio because I really could not relate very much to the MGM product. I found, actually, Mimi and St. Louis abominable. I mean, I was only 8 or 9 at the time. But, you know, when the father comes home and says, you know, we're going to have to move to New York, and the kids say, oh, my God, leave St. Louis and go to New York. I mean, my God, I would have given, growing up as I did in Scranton, Pennsylvania, I would have given anything to go to New York. And I just could not understand that kind of a film. But you see, the Paramount films at the time, particularly the road movies with Bing Crosby, Bob Hope, and Dorothy Lamour, they were very accessible to kids. And the Betty Hutton movies were very accessible to kids. So, yeah, Paramount was a great favorite of mine. Yeah, that and Universal.
Yeah, I was going to say right at the towards the beginning of the book, you talk about this. And nowadays, people don't think about it because... You know, it's unless you're studying studio histories, that each of the major studios had its specialties and its specializations in many ways. So, for example, you mentioned that Universal was particularly known for its monster and horror films and some of the other ones that you've mentioned. And so Paramount, as you just said, they tended to make movies that were accessible and therefore became popular in that way, and you've said that some of the other ones weren't as interesting to you.
Yes, that's true. Paramount, Universal, and Warner Brothers were my favorite studios. I mean, I adored Betty Davis. I mean, I just never saw anything like that. That was a phenomenon, you know. And actors like Bogart and Cagney, they were all so distinctive. And although they talked very fast, you could understand every word they said, as opposed to today. Frankly, you know, if I get maybe half of the dialogue, I'm doing well.
Yeah, there's no question the concepts of movie making have changed so much, and the concepts of how people consume that material has changed so much from the older period. I've seen a couple of things where even as time went on during the Golden Age period, where like there was a remake of some films, and you see differences with how it's presented even from 1 year to maybe 4 or 5 years later. So
yeah,
the changes was constant. So the first chapter obviously is meant to be an overall history of the studio and how it started. Obviously, Adolf Zukor is the person who is most known for the studio by name. He lived throughout this for a good portion of this period, and you know, into his 90s. So he was there for a lot of this, and in many ways he was similar to some of the other studio heads or people that became studio heads back in that period, in that he was an immigrant, and he started with, or his family was, maybe I don't remember the specifics now, but learned about movies from the Nickelodeons and the other basic filmmaking that was going on in the early 1900s. So let's talk a little bit about Zukor and what he brought to what became Paramount Pictures.
Well, Zukor actually began as a furrier. I mean, he was certainly aware of the Nickelodeon business, and particularly the kinetoscope machines. They were peep show machines. You put a nickel in the slot. You turn the wheel, and you would see film clips. And they were very big in penny arcades. So he realized that there was a business there, and then he went into the penny arcade business. Then when the Nickelodeon era began, he went into the purchase of Nickelodeons, because it was not very difficult to open up a Nickelodeon. You looked for a storefront, and you got film. You got a projector, you rented chairs from a funeral parlor or some social club, and you could get a marker for yourself to popularize your fare for the day, and that was it. But it didn't stop there. I think once you are bitten by the exhibition bug and you start opening up Nickelodeons, then, you know, you realize that you're going to have to get product for those Nickelodeons. You're going to have to go to the film exchanges and pick up films to be shown. So you go into distribution. Why do I have to go to film exchanges? I'll open up my own film exchange or series of film exchanges. But then that's not enough. You have to go into production. And that's what actually did happen. He hooked up with this man called Hodgkinson, and Hodgkinson had an exchange called Progressive Film, and he wanted a company that whose name began with a P. Well, he couldn't use Progressive because it was the name of the distribution company, so he came up with Paramount, and that wasn't enough because you have a picture of a mountaintop, but, you know, one mountaintop is like any other mountaintop. So he decided to encircle the mountain with stars. So it became a Star-Spangled Mountain, and that became, and it is even true today, the Paramount logo.
Right. It's there are a few of those logos. Paramount's the most obvious one, but Universal still has the Globe logo, at least in some format or another, and
yes.
20th Century Fox, even though at the time when it first was just Fox when it first started, but they're still using a logo that's pretty similar. So the studio, at least that part of that period, still those logos are still considered to be important as far as distinguishing the studio.
Well, you know, they distinguish the studios today, but let's face it. I mean, you know, a film made by 20th Century Fox today could have been made by Columbia, depending upon who cut the deal. You know.
And we've seen that now, especially with the with the norm now of series of movies and such, those kind of things change. The James Bond movies obviously started with United Artists, but that doesn't exist anymore, and they've gone all over the place. I think they're with Sony now, so depending on the age of the film, you definitely see a different logo, because as you point out, they're basically the studio, or whoever identifies themselves as the studio is just a distributor in this case.
Yeah, that's all. That's all the studios are. They're studios in name only. They're distribution outfits.
So Zucker obviously followed is one of the first one of the few initial folks who started studios just to get material, and then also was buying up property in order to come up with a way to show the material. So we early on in the studio system, we have this where not only is it just the fact that you're the producer, but you're also the exhibitor, which of course would eventually come back to haunt them. But some of the important aspects of Paramount are their various theaters, including...
Oh my goodness, yes. I remember when, Paramount had the biggest theater chain of any of the studios. It was called Paramount Publix. But, Lord, I remember coming to New York for maybe the second or third time, and I just had to see the Paramount Theater, which was on Broadway between 43rd and 44th Street. And that's where, of course, Frank Sinatra was mobbed whenever he appeared at the Paramount, because in those days, at certain theaters in New York, like the Paramount, like the Capitol, you had not only the feature film, but you had a stage show. And the stage show would very frequently feature top singers like Fran Warren, like Joe Stafford, of course, like Frank Sinatra. But yeah, I had to see the Paramount. And of course, what it is today is the Hard Rock Cafe. But the facade is still there, because you had the Paramount Theater at ground level, and then you had the offices above, the Paramount offices above. It was 1501 Broadway.
I know I'm from Cleveland, although I don't live there right now, and we have a number of older theaters that used to show feature films, and I still remember going there to see Sound of Music when it first came out. In a roadshow and you know, reserve seating and everything. And
oh, yeah, sure.
So, obviously, though, Paramount became very successful pretty early on in this sense that they were able to develop as feature films became real features, as opposed to short films or, as you say, the Nickelodeons. And, in fact, they made... Paramount's known for the first Best Picture that ever won an Oscar, Wings.
Yeah, Wings. Yeah, sure.
It's Clara funny Bow, that they've just recently reissued it in a restored version. And at the beginning, they show all the Paramount logos from the beginning to, or actually
oh,
they
do
go
they,
in reverse.
Yeah.
So it's strange, but when we talk about logos, that the Paramount logo really hasn't changed that much, even though obviously all the other things changed. But who were some of the initial people who Paramount was able to get both in the front of the cameras and the back of the camera that helped to create its signature?
Well, in the silent period, they had, of course, Gloria Swanson. And in Sunset Boulevard, when Gloria Swanson, who plays, of course, Norma Desmond, says, you know, I built a studio, referring to Paramount, and without me, there wouldn't have been a Paramount. She's not exactly telling a falsehood, but yeah, she was a very important star. Valentino was a Paramount star in the silent era. And then when you move into the 30s, of course, you get great directors. They had Ernst Lubitsch for a time. And directed some wonderful, they were really musicals with Jeanette MacDonald, One Hour with you and Monte Carlo, where she introduced the song Beyond the Blue Horizon. And that was the period of the great directors, because then you got directors like in the 40s, Preston Sturges, who really made a series of brilliant comedies. And unfortunately, his career was short-lived, because by about 1944, it was virtually over. He made a couple of films at 20th Century Fox, Unfaithful Yours and Beautiful Blonde from Bashful Bend. But in his heyday, I mean, movies like The Great McGinty, The Lady Eve, and Sullivan's Travels, and The Miracle at Morgan's Creek, and Hail the Conquering Hero, those were brilliant comedies. And then, of course, you had Billy Wilder making his first movie at Paramount, The Major and the Minor, with Ginger Rogers, playing a woman who disguises herself as a 12-year-old so she can ride half price back home to wherever it was in the Midwest. But yeah, those were glory years for Paramount.
So obviously, Paramount and studios pretty much operated the way they did for, I don't know, I would say a good 20 years, if not more, until over time we start to see changes for a variety of reasons. But Paramount, clearly, as you discussed in the early chapters, was clearly one of the most successful during the period. But over time we start to see, and this is not a new story, but as studios start to run into issues that would eventually, as we now know, in the studio system, one of the first was, I don't know if it's the first, but we start to see that little by little, the studios are getting into trouble because they also own their ownership of the theaters and the exhibition part of the process. And Paramount, like the others, begins to get into an issue where they have to start divesting themselves of that aspect of their business.
Yes, that was the consent decree. And of course, it's sometimes called the Paramount decision, because Paramount had more theaters than any other studio, because Paramount, like MGM, like Warner Brothers, was vertically integrated. You produced your films, you distributed your films, and you exhibited them in your own theater chain. So, yeah, certainly that contributed to the a deterioration of the studio system. But then, of course, you know, there was a question of age. The stars began to age, and they really weren't capable of playing the same roles that they did 10 years earlier. And as the stars aged, the new stars came in. But as the new stars were coming in, the studio system was coming apart, because television was... And I certainly know this, having grown up, I grew up in the 40s, but I was well aware of the impact of television in the 1950s, because you would look at the marquee of your neighborhood theater one day, and there'd be a movie advertised on it. The next day, the theater marquee would be blank, and there was nothing in the paper that said the theater went out of business. A couple weeks later, it became a chain store or a supermarket, if it was large enough. But I mean, you were aware of the fact, I was certainly growing up, that something was changing. I couldn't quite articulate it because I was, you know, a kid, but I knew that it wasn't the same. And particularly when you started seeing, you know, younger actors like Marlon Brando, like Paul Newman, like Joanne Woodward. I mean, these were not the same people that I knew from the 1940s. So, yeah, it was coming apart. And, of course, the first major studio to cease production was RKO in 1957, which was very early.
Yeah, and one of the, you were talking about movie theaters that would disappear and then be repurposed. I can think the theater I used to go to as a kid, of course, this was been in the 60s, is now a church. It's still, the marquee actually still exists, but it's a church. I can think of one that became a car dealership. They repurposed the buildings. Of course, one of the other things, and we're talking about how the studio system started to come apart, was that the studios themselves started more and more contracting out for material rather than producing it themselves directly. It was not unusual to have a star or producer or something similar like that, or a director, be somebody who had basic control over the material, and that's something else that took away some of the power of the studios.
Yes, well, that started really right after World War II with Liberty Productions. It didn't go very far, but with Frank Capra and a few others. Then Bogart started his production company, Santana, releasing through Columbia. That's why in 1956, Zanuck left 20th Century Fox to form his own company, and he would base his company in Paris. He said, I have to get out of Hollywood because it's being run by agents, by stars who want authority over everything. They want to pass on their own stills, their own images, everything. It just has been taken out of the hands of producers. So he considered himself, and he was, it is true, a creative producer. But if a producer is not allowed to exhibit his or her creativity because everything becomes a package deal, the agent puts the package together with the star, with the writer, with the director, and just hands it to the studio, and this is it. You like, as Bloody Mary says in South Pacific, oh, you like, you buy. You know, that was it.
And quite a bit of the book, especially in this period, you talk a lot about the finances and also the statistics that you give as far as even how much they spend on advertising, how much the fights with the producers or with the outside people to try to come up with suitable budgets and things, and how the studio was often caught having to figure out a way to actually continue to make money.
Advertising a film these days is almost as expensive as producing it.
Yeah, you gave an example of that the average budget now for advertising is almost, depending on the film, could be close to the cost of the actual filmmaking.
That's right, yes.
And in the book, then, as during this period where things are starting to unravel or change, this is where we bring in George Weltner, who was an important part of the early part of the first part of the book before Gulf and Western appeared. And so let's talk a little bit more about Weltner, because he's an interesting person in that he never considered himself to be a creative person. That wasn't what he considered to be his forte, and yet he becomes very important to the latter part of Paramount as a separate studio. Who is George Weltner? Who was George Weltner and his
importance? Well, George Weltner, you would not know this from his name, but he was Hungarian. His parents were Hungarian, and that's why they had contact with Zucker. Zucker would take very good care of any of his fellow Hungarians. And when George graduated in 1922 from Columbia with a degree in chemical engineering, he was hired to work in the film processing lab at the Paramount studio in Astoria. Now, Paramount had a studio in Astoria, Queens, and it also, of course, had the one on Marathon Street in Los Angeles, in Hollywood. But the good thing about the Astoria studio is that if you were New York-based or if you were in a play, you could pick up extra money by going across the Queensboro Bridge to the Astoria studio, work during the morning and afternoon, and then come back and do your show at night. And once George Weltner I got this job at Film Processing Lab, he realized how important distribution is because they were preparing the films to be distributed both domestically and internationally. So he kept moving up into distribution. And then when there was nobody to take over from Barney Balaban when he retired, this would have been in 1964, Weltner became president of Paramount. Didn't last very long. In 67, he was out because in 66, of course, Charlie Bluthorn bought Paramount. So there was no room for him in the new Paramount, which is, of course, what often happens. So, yes, he really rose to the occasion. I mean, production, of course, was not his forte. But he did have to deal with people like Hal Wallace, because Hal Wallace had his own production company at Paramount at the time. And he wanted a release date for one of his pictures. Weltner wanted a release date for the same picture, but a different release date. And of course, they clashed. And obviously, Weltner had to give in to Wallace.
Yeah, this is where the and I can tell because you had access to his collection at, as you mentioned earlier, University of Wyoming's American Heritage Center. We get a lot of information about what Weltner was going through because I'm guessing because of that collection really helped to build out that part of the book.
Oh, it really did. I really felt sorry for the poor man because I did talk with his son, Jack, who's a doctor. But Jack says that towards the end of his life, George developed dementia. And at one point, really didn't even know where he was, and was looking forward to a nice long retirement after having fought the Battle of Paramount, and you know, just faded away as happens with people with dementia. I mean, they're just hate to use a cliche, but they are a shell of their former self, and that's what happened to Jack Weltner. So it's never a happy ending in Hollywood. I mean, even though Hollywood made some marvelous movies with happy endings, the people involved in the creative end of movie making really didn't have happy endings.
So, I mean, obviously, what kind of material is, I mean, you mentioned briefly but in the introduction but or in your preface, but what kind of materials is in the archives? I mean, obviously, I'm going to assume memos, but is that the large portion?
Memos, letters, budgets, particularly. I mean, everything. It's just the most comprehensive archive I've ever seen. I mean, everything that George Weltner brought from Paramount ended up at the American Heritage Center.
I know, because you can tell from some of the stories that you include or some of the situations that you include. I can think of the most obvious one is the issues with Jerry Lewis that come through in the book, where clearly there were disagreements going on between Lewis and the studio.
Yeah, well, that was the whole problem with somebody like Jerry Lewis, who was actually a brilliant comic, but he has an enormous ego. Now, Hal Wallace, who actually was responsible for Jerry Lewis, because the first Jerry Lewis Dean Martin movie was My Friend Irma, which was produced by Hal Wallace. Hal Wallace realized that in order to survive, you just couldn't keep making, you know, artistic films like Come Back, Little Sheba, and The Rose Tattoo. I mean, you know, you had to. Paramount was known for comedies, particularly the road movies. So he gets Martin and Lewis, and then Lewis and Martin separate, and Martin goes off and actually makes some decent films, particularly Some Came Running, on which I thought he gave a great performance. And Lewis stays on and does, you know, Ladies' Man and Cinderella and Visit to a Small Planet and things of that sort, which were really not particularly good films. Well, Hal Wallace would have been able to contain him. But you see, Weltner was the one who had to take the flak because Weltner, having never been in production, unlike Wallace, who was a producer, you don't know anything about stars and their egos.
And Jerry Lewis had a pretty big one. I mean, not that they all don't, but he definitely seemed to have some of the biggest ones.
He certainly did. Well, a lot of people who are comics are essentially insecure, and they make up for it by developing a very oversized ego.
So then at this point, then, Weltner's finally become president, almost like there was nobody else left. So
That's right, yeah.
It was sort of like, okay, you're president now. But as you point out, it didn't last very long. We now get into the period which is the real aspect, the important aspect of what we're talking about, which is how studios became cogs in the wheels of business. Other types of businesses, and to talk about that, I guess I want to ask: Paramount was not the first to be bought out, but when do we see the first studio being bought by someone outside of the industry?
Well, Decca Records I think about 1956 bought Columbia. Universal. I'm sorry. In the 80s, Coca-Cola bought Columbia, which does seem like a disconnect. But I remember Variety's headline was, Fizzbiz meets Showbiz. And why Coca-Cola bought Columbia is not terribly difficult to figure out. But I mean, look, you have a lot. Any exhibitor will tell you, do you make most of your money at the concession stand? So for your soft drink, you feature Coca-Cola.
So going into this now, we've got, and I think the way you explained it was, we start to see agents start to get more involved in aspects of the business, if I remember that right, from one of the from this point in the book.
Yeah, particularly agencies like Creative Artists, CAA, Creative Artists Agency. That was Mike Ovitz's company. Of course, there was always the William Morris, now William Morris Endeavor, ICM, International Creative. That's why, as I said, Daryl Zanuck simply left 20th Century Fox. Of course, he came back later, but not as a producer. He came back as head of the studio, as president.
And I know nowadays it's not unusual at all for a studio or a production head to be a former agent. That's just become, producers tend to come up through that ranks nowadays.
Yeah.
So, as we talk about the purchase or the takeover of Paramount by Gulf and Western, what was Gulf and Western's business?
Well, Charlie Bluhorn, who's known as the Mad Austrian, who was either Jewish or Christian, depending on to whom you were speaking, just built up this incredibly diversified company called Gulf and Western, which had interest in everything from beef and cigars to zinc, and it even had a financing division. So it was all over the place. It was a mega conglomerate, which is really what it was. And Charlie Bluhorn got on the board of Paramount, and the acquisition of Paramount reminds me very much of a scene in Citizen Kane, where Charles Foster Kane is going through all of his assets, and he discovers that one of the things he owns after his mother's death is a newspaper. And he says, I think it might be fun to run a newspaper. I really think, I can imagine Charlie Bluhorn looking at Paramount and saying, gee, I think it would be fun to run a movie studio, or to own a movie studio. Because let's face it, there is something sexy about Hollywood, about movies, about movie stars. I mean, when Coca-Cola owned Columbia, you had all of these Coca-Cola executives from Atlanta, going on a boondoggle to Los Angeles to come back and say, oh, I was at a party with Jane and Bobby and Marty, you know, Jane Fonda, Martin Scorsese, Robert De Niro. But, you know, they're just bragging about the celebrities that they saw. The celebrities probably had no choice but to be kind to them because, you know, that's where the money was. But there was something, and I can understand that appeal of a studio.
The funny part about it is we see the same thing with sports teams.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's another example of people who want, you know, multi-billionaires who want to own sports teams, not because they're necessarily money makers, but the prestige aspect.
Yeah, to be photographed with a ball player or to have access to a bullpen.
So, obviously, Blue Dorn is able to eventually get control of Paramount for Gulf and Western. How did things change very quickly? I'm assuming it changed quickly. I mean, once he took over.
Oh, but once he took over, he realized that movie making was not really his thing. And actually, what he did, and it was only for a very short period, but what he did was to get Peter Bart and Robert Evans, who were two extraordinary men, to run production. Now, the production head, for all practical purposes, although that term was not used, was Robert Evans. And Peter Bart had a title, I think it was something like Vice President Creative, whatever. But the two worked together because Evans really was a visionary, but he did not have much of an education. Bart, on the other hand, had a degree from Swarthmore and the London School of Economics, and together they really functioned as a team. Now, it was Bart's idea to option Mario Puzo's The Godfather, and then, of course, it was an enormous task on the part of Robert Evans to pitch it to the Paramount board because you were making a movie about the mafia. And there were all kinds of threats coming in and so forth. But he decided that, yeah, it's about the mafia, it's about the Cosa Nostra, but it's also about a family. So if the script, which was written by Francis Ford Coppola and Mario Puzo, and Coppola, although we think of him today as a director, he won an Oscar for the screenplay of Patton with George Scott. But if you make the movie in such a way that it centers around a family, then you can actually sell it to the masses. And it was amazing, because I remember this very well, an R-rated movie in 1972, like The Godfather, did attract families. That when I saw it in a neighborhood theater in New Jersey, I mean, there were parents with their kids.
That is unusual,
yeah,
given the film.
And you learn the lessons from that. You know, remember Omerta, the law of silence. You know, you don't snitch. Otherwise, you get killed, you know. And brother may have to kill brother.
So Gulf and Western is obviously a mega corporation that takes over Paramount. What happens to the financial aspects of Paramount? Do we get changes because suddenly they've got to that the overall corporation starts looking at bottom lines?
No, actually, Paramount was in there were various divisions in Gulf and Western. There was the agricultural division. There was a financing division. There was metals division. This was Leisure Time. So if Paramount, for example, if the films did not do as well as had been expected, you know, there were other things that were selling, like beef, like cigars, like New Jersey Zinc, you know. I mean, one offsets the other.
Did, of these studios that were, and we know we're talking about Paramount, but as we've pointed out, they all pretty much fell under the roles of just being another part of a corporation. How did Paramount compare as far as continued being able to continue on versus some of the other corporations that took over studios?
Well, Universal is a prime example. I mean, poor Universal. It was taken over by Decca Records. Then it was merged. First it was merged with International and became Universal International. Then it was taken over by Decca Records. Then it was taken over by MCA, Lou Wasserman's company. And once Wasserman had it, he had it for a while. This was the time in the late 1980s, around 1988-89, Sony became very interested in getting into the movie business. So Sony bought Columbia in 1989, and then the other Japanese company, Matsushita, which is primarily known for the Panasonic product, bought Universal. So here you have Universal now being owned by a maker of consumer products like Matsushita. Well, they didn't know because they were Japanese. I mean, it was alien to them having a movie studio. So they unloaded it on Seagram because Edgar Bromfman Jr. Fancied himself a producer. So now you have a maker of alcoholic beverages owning a movie studio. Then Seagram dumped Universal and was taken over by Vivendi, a French company, and that didn't work out. Then General Electric, which had NBC at the time, bought Universal and merged it with NBC, and it became NBC Universal. And then General Electric wanted to get out of the business, so it unloaded NBC Universal onto Comcast. So the latest owner of Universal is Comcast. So it went from Decca Records to Comcast.
And of course, that's similar. It's funny because you just told the story of Universal to the president, and in many ways, Paramount's story is very similar. It goes through, and we can talk about that. But how long did Gulf and Western actually own Paramount, and what led to changing over?
Well, in 1978, Charlie Bluthorn was diagnosed with leukemia, and as soon as he got the diagnosis, he started spinning off various divisions. And he died in 83 or 84, I don't remember. And once he passed away, Martin Davis, who was on the board of Gulf and Western, took over, and he got rid of the rest of the divisions but kept Paramount Communications. Paramount, which was then Paramount Pictures Corporation. So what was left of Gulf and Western was Paramount, Paramount Television, Desilu Studios, where, of course, I Love Lucy was filmed, and Famous Music, the music publishing division, and Simon & Schuster. So that was a nice little package if anybody wanted to buy it. And eventually, Sumner Redstone did. But before he bought Paramount, he bought Viacom from CBS.
And, of course, that's where we get to the more current period where Viacom, CBS, and Paramount are together and under the control, as you say, of Sumner Redstone. And what was his background?
Well, Sumner Redstone is the exact opposite of Charlie Bluthorn, who didn't really have much of an education. Now, Sumner Redstone is Boston Latin School, Harvard BA, Harvard Law. So, I mean, very impressive credentials. And his father, Michael, owned National Amusements, which was a theater chain, and at the time was the seventh largest theater chain in the country. Although, you know, who knows what it's going to be like now. I don't know what it's like where you are, but in New York, the Angelica has opened. Film Forum is opened. Maybe one or two other small ones, but, you know, AMC, no, not at all. And I don't really know what is going to happen to these theater chains, particularly now with the Delta variant. But, you know, Michael, the father, did build up, not exactly an empire, but certainly a fiefdom of theaters. And, of course, Sumner took that over when the father died. But, you know, that wasn't enough. You see, it's the same with Zucker. It's not enough to own a Penny Arcade. It's not enough to own a Nickelodeon. It's not enough to have your own distribution outfit. He wanted more, and he wanted more. He wanted more. And he found out that CBS had its own a syndication operation called Viacom. But because of the new ruling called FinCEN, Financial Interest in Syndication, a network could not own a syndication division. So Viacom was up for sale, and Sumner bought it. And that was around 1986, 1987. Now, and that wasn't enough for him. When Paramount was available after Charlie Bluedorn's death, Redstone decided, I'm going to add that Paramount Studios to Viacom. And that wasn't even enough, because in 1999, he realized that the other studios had networks. Disney had ABC. At the time, I guess it would have been GE, had NBC. And so what was
CBS
left?
was the one that was still there.
Yes, CBS. Well, the Fox channel was owned by Rupert Murdoch, and the only game in town was CBS. So Mel Karmazin actually merged CBS with Viacom, becoming not CBS Viacom. Viacom comes first. Viacom CBS, which was the exact opposite of NBC Universal, where the network preceded the studio name. And of course, Karmazin thought, well, you know, Sumner's in his 70s. I mean, he's not going to go on forever. Little did he know that Sumner had every intention of going on forever.
And in fact, that's where we sort of dovetail between what you originally wrote. And then the newer material in the new introduction to the paperback edition, where you continue to bring the story forward. What is interesting is it seems like you're right. They want to hold on to that name. So, for example, while all the different companies have their own streaming services now, Paramount seems to have been the one that still has a studio name on it. NBC's is called Peacock, so there's no sign of anything there, and none of the other ones mentioned studio names, but Paramount still is called Paramount Plus, so they're still holding on to that name.
Well, they should. It's a very venerable name. I mean, the studio goes back to, I think, 1917.
Right. So, obviously, Mel Karmazin becomes the person that sort of bridges the original book and then the new material, And the big issue, obviously, as you point out, is that he wants to have control and is never able to get it.
Yes, and I think he realized it, so he pulled out. But, you know, he was not meant to run Viacom. I mean, Karmazin's was great in radio. As a matter of fact, radio was his preferred medium.
Well, that's part of the whole thing about how... You know, these conglomerates had all kinds of media material, properties, and radio at that point, at least, was incredibly important still.
Yeah. Well, in his heyday, Sumner could run the whole show. But, of course, beginning, I guess, around 2011, he began to deteriorate. He became erratic in restaurants, and as a matter of fact, many restaurants didn't want him to return. He became persona non grata.
So, obviously, that takes us pretty close to present day. I mean, who, currently speaking, who is in charge of Paramount?
Well, Backish is the president, but of course now the daughter, Sherry Redstone, runs the show. So she is really head of Viacom. And actually, I have great sympathy and respect for Sherry Redstone. It must have been hell for the last several years when Sumner developed this insatiable desire for sex and steak. And you know, all these women were servicing him. I mean, he had one mistress after another and one caregiver after another, and he gave them houses. He actually bought for his last two women houses that cost over $1 million each. And for the daughter to have to sit by and watch the way her father was, first of all, deteriorating, and secondly, always refusing the control that she really wanted. I mean, when she married Rabbi Korf, Ira Korf, I mean, you know, Sumner was enthralled because Korf had all these degrees, including a PhD from Tufts, you know. That impressed Sumner. Sumner actually made Ira Korf, who had no experience whatsoever in media, the vice president of National Amusements, and then later made him president. Now, you have the daughter standing by and watching her husband being elevated step by step, where she's at the bottom rung of the ladder. Mm-hmm. And she was well-educated, too. She had a law degree as well. Sumner had given up on his son, Brent, because he realized that Brent was not meant for the corporate world, so he was trying to groom successors. But you see, the trouble with being a patriarch like Sumner Redstone is that you think in terms of sons. Or if you can't have a son, you want a son surrogate. The last thing in the world you would think of was your daughter.
Right. So, obviously, the corporate aspect of Paramount is still pretty involved in a corporate speak. So the book definitely shows how we got to the present day, and there's no question that you were able to pull together a lot of information, not only from Weltner's material but from other sources. And I think one of the things that I found most interesting in the discussions throughout the book was all of the numbers you were able to pull together, statistics of finances and other things, especially back in the production days where you could see where it became such an issue with working and producing and the financial aspect of it. So, but nowadays we're in a position where these various what remains of the studios still have value, even if they've completely changed the way they work.
Yeah. Well, I owe a great deal to George Weltner because he kept everything.
Well,
excuse me. Yeah.
No, go on. I'm sorry. I didn't.
No, and that's why it, in many ways, it was not even a chore to do it. He made it so easy for me.
So, it sounds like, this update definitely went along with the other material. It's a good reason for people to not only go back to the original material, but also to get the update of what has changed since you first wrote the book. So, I really think this is a book that does a great job of explaining what happened to a particular studio and to a lesser extent the rest of Hollywood over the more than 100 years of Hollywood movie making. So I really appreciate the time you were able to spend with me about talking about Paramount Pictures. And as you say, the title is engulfed, and obviously the gulf comes right straight from Gulf and Western, but we can see that it hasn't stopped, and these media conglomerates have continued to be there. And I really appreciate the detail that you provided and the discussion we had.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you.
Thank you. My thanks to Bernard. I hope you will find his study of Paramount to be interesting and illuminating. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network.